Wisconsin Vegetable Garden Radio Show with your hosts, Joey and Holly Baird.
It is the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Radio Show on the Wisconsin on WNOV 860 AM and W293 CX 106.5. The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener.com, your destination. 960 plus videos, Instagram, Twitter, and a whole Facebook, and a whole lot more. There you go. So let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Holly, to bring in our next guest.
Jessica Walliser co-hosts the Organic Gardeners on KDK Radio in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She's a regular contributor to Fine Garden, Urban Farm, and Hobby Farm magazines. She also serves on the editorial advisory board of the American Horticultural Society, and she's also an author and devoted bug lover. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thanks so much, Joey and Holly. How are you guys today?
We are well. Thank you for taking time out of your day to join us on the program. Now, for people who are wanting to, if that sounds familiar, Pittsburgh, your co-host, Doug Oster, was on about show 13-ish, 14, somewhere in there a couple months ago, and that's where the familiarity to some of our listeners may come from.
Excellent. I heard he had a very good time, so I'm sure I'll have the same.
Well, we tried to figure out if he was above or below or across from us, but I think we just got that figured out. Let's start with this. You are a horticulturist. For those who have no idea what that is, what is a horticulturist, and what is the difference between that and a master gardener?
Ah, that's a very good question. So a horticulturist is someone who has essentially usually a four-year degree, a bachelor's degree in horticulture. So, for example, I went to Penn State University for horticulture. I learned about everything from plant pathology and taxonomy and nutrition to, soil science and entomology. So it's a four-year degree, just like a teaching degree or something like that, whereas a master gardener is a volunteer-in-training program. So the master gardener is usually done through the state extension service in whatever state you live in, and you go through a training program that usually lasts several months, where you learn sort of a little bit about everything about gardening. So someone like me teaches a master gardener. So that's sort of the difference between the two of them.
Okay, so you're the teacher, you went through the educational process, and master gardeners are people who are just normal individuals who want to be given that title after they achieve a certain criteria.
Absolutely, and master gardeners are essential for so many gardening programs, school gardens, educational workshops and programs, educating the community about smart gardening practices. Master gardeners are absolutely essential for that, there's a wonderful volunteer base, especially here in Western Pennsylvania, and they do very, very good work.
Fantastic. Now, some people may see a lot of ants in their garden, and maybe they are not sure what's going on there. Is that a good or a bad thing? Is it beneficial or harmful?
Well, it's interesting that you should, bring up ants and especially insects in general, because though I am a trained horticulturist, I'm also an amateur entomologist. And my focus really over the last couple of years has switched from promoting, plants in the garden and doing everything revolving around plants. And instead, it has shifted to really promoting the other creatures that share our gardens with us, including lots of insects. And ants is on that list. So, putting them in that category of whether they're good or bad is essentially categorizing them for us humans. In the garden, they do not cause damage. Sometimes they may get after seedlings or eat a few seeds here and there as you plant them, but in general, they're considered to be very beneficial to the garden, with the exception, of course, of fire ants, which are an invasive species. I don't think they've made it to Wisconsin yet, and I don't think they ever will, but they can really be harmful to gardeners, obviously, because they bite. But in general, in a garden, ants are considered to be very good things.
Well, let's talk about good bugs. What is the most misunderstood good bug in your garden that everyone thinks is a bad bug?
Oh, my gosh, the most misunderstood. Well, there's a lot of misunderstood bugs in general, I think. People, they all have that ick factor, so people kind of freak out when they see a bug in the garden. But it's actually less than 1% of the million or so identified insect species on the planet that are classified as agriculture or human pests. So it's a very small number that are considered to be pests. But I would say of all of the good bugs, like the ladybugs and the lacewings that live out in the garden, probably the most misunderstood are the paper wasps. which some people will call yellow jackets or hornets or a different type of them. They make sort of that big papery nest either up in a tree or down under the ground. And in general, people see them as being wicked because in the fall they can grow pretty aggressive. But the reality is that a single nest of those guys can eat tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of pests out of your garden. I watch them every day taking the cabbage worms off my cabbage plants and flying them back to their nest to feed the young. So if you come across one of those nests in your yard or garden, try to give it a wide berth, you know, cordon it off with some caution tape. Don't destroy it. Those nests are only used for 1 year, and then they're abandoned in the fall. The only one that survives the fall is the fertilized queen. So, you know, they're in general, although we think of them as being really bad, they're really, really incredibly good for the garden.
Right, and most times if you don't bother them, they won't bother you. But if you start poking around, they're going to come after you.
Right, yeah. Right. If you're going to throw rocks at it or something like that, that's really bad news. Now, obviously, you know, if the nest is where your kids are playing or it's right by your front door, then you're going to want to take some type of control measures. But if it's not way up in a tree or way out at the back of your property, just leave it be. As I said, they're really, really good for the garden.
Well, another insect that eats a lot of bad bugs are ladybugs. And one of their big buffet items is aphids. And they can go through, a couple of dozen or maybe 100 of aphids a day?
Absolutely. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that we have about 450 different species of ladybugs here in North America. And there's a lot of them that are not red with black spots. You know, they're all different colors. Some of them have stripes. Some of them have no spots at all. One of my favorite species is called the ashy gray, and it's a beautiful gray ladybug with black spots. But it's arboreal. It spends its whole life up in the trees. So, you know, unless you're an arborist or a monkey, you're never going to see that species most your whole life. So it's important to learn the role that they play and give them a chance to do their work in your garden, because they really do control a very broad diversity of pests.
And that's what we keep preaching on our program, our videos, our website, and you and Doug as well. If you decide to spray a chemical on your property to control what you believe is a bad bug, that chemical is not, it will kill all the bad bugs. It doesn't just go, oh, well, I'm only supposed to kill X bug. I'll not affect anything else.
Absolutely. And that's what I like to call collateral damage. There's a lot of collateral damage. And people think sometimes even, well, if I just spray, you know, horticultural oil or insecticidal soap, that's going to be better. You know, that's going to be better than a chemical pesticide because, you know, it's labeled as organic. And though, yes, it is better certainly for the safety of the human user, it may not necessarily be better for all of the good insects. So if we think about, you know, it's labeled as safe for use around beneficials, what they test it on are like the adults. So they will test it on an adult ladybug. They won't test it on the soft-bodied larva or on the eggs of those ladybugs. So while it says it's safe for use on beneficials, it's only on the adult beneficials. So in my garden, I haven't sprayed anything in almost, we've lived here now 12 years. So in about 12 years, organic or otherwise, I haven't sprayed. I have a really good balance between beneficial insects and the bad guys, so they keep each other in check.
Now, as we're getting to the hottest part of the summer, when you read online, it'll say, like, this plant needs this amount of water per week. How do you judge that, or is that just a garden myth?
That's a really great question. So, you know, yeah, we can put these guidelines, and I think, you know, we as humans and as gardeners sort of, we need to know the rules, right? We need to know, how much do I water this, how often, and how much do I put on it? But you and I know, right, as experienced gardeners, that there's a lot of wiggle room in that. That some plants are certainly more drought resistant than others, that it depends on how much rain you get, how, you know, dense your soil is, how well will the water percolate down into the plant's roots. So we learn to sort of play it by ear, right, when we water our plants. We know what cues to look for from the plant that let us know that it's time to water them. We want to water, obviously, just before drought stress occurs. We want to try to catch them before they wilt, if at all possible. Sometimes it's a matter of just sticking your finger down into the soil and seeing how much moisture it needs. But you can definitely pay attention to the drought resistance of plants. So something like a succulent isn't going to need to be irrigated nearly as much as something like a tomato, which requires a lot more moisture. So you kind of learn to wing it. eventually.
Right, and just like it's a guideline. If the seed packet says planted a half inch deep, if you get a quarter inch deep or three quarters or an inch deep, that sucker's going to grow no matter what. It's just a guideline you would kind of want to follow, but it's not scientific proof. Oh, I'm too deep. It's not going to grow.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are sometimes, you know, obviously if you don't water at all or you don't bury the seed and it's one that requires darkness for germination, you know, that can obviously influence those things as well. But, I mean, gardening is really, it's a flexible hobby. So you don't have to do everything 100% right all the time.
Well, I want to bring up this question since you're a horticulturist. What is the purpose of topping or stubbing cutting of trees in people's front yards? They basically knock all the limbs off, and there's just it's just giant hat rack basically in the front yard. It's just a bunch of stalks and limbs. Why do people do this? And this is one of the worst things you can do for a tree. And if people don't know what I'm talking about, go to your favorite search engine and type in topping trees, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a holdover from the 70s, to be honest with you. I mean, in the 1970s, driving through my neighborhood as a kid, everybody topped their trees because, you know, some dude with his name slapped on the side of a truck, you know, Joe the tree guy, said, oh, your tree's getting too big, it's going to fall on your house, so I'm going to take some of this weight off by, you know, topping the tree. But really what that practice does is it generates weak growth, water sprouts. It is an entry route for fungal diseases and pathogens, and that's what makes it one of the worst practices. I mean, a tree, just like people, it's genetically determined how high you're supposed to grow, right? How tall you're going to get. So with a tree, if you're talking about a tree that's supposed to get 60 feet tall and you prune it, it's going to have a lot of negative consequences to that when you go ahead and top that tree right away. So be smart about what trees you're planting. Make sure you pick ones that are only going to grow to the height that you want them to grow. And the practice really needs to be stopped. I mean, it's just an old-fashioned gardening practice. Its time is over. People do not need to do this anymore.
Well, and if you're going to decide to purchase a tree, there is a tag on it that says this tree will grow average of 10 foot a year and total of 80 foot in X amount of years. If you're looking, you've got to know what you want before you go into it. If you're going to buy a tree to plant, you just don't want to grab something that's on sale, put it in the ground, and then have to deal with the consequences 6 years down the road.
Absolutely. It's like you're not going to send your child to a daycare without, you know, researching that daycare first, right, to find out if it's the right fit for your child. Same thing. You know, is this tree the right fit for your yard? Is it going to, you know, reach the height and the girth that you want and not get so far out of bounds?
I would recommend a fruit-bearing tree so you have something of return and investment, but that's just my personal professional thought on that.
Now,
I agree. I love that. And flowers. Flowers aren't bad either.
Right.
Definitely. Where can people find you and your books?
Yeah. So pretty much the easiest place to get me is my website, which is just my name, Jessica Walliser. It's Walliser at JessicaWalliser.com is what it is. I want to give you my email address. JessicaWalliser.com, and on there you can contact me via email through that website, and you can learn more about my books. I have several out. Probably the two most popular ones are Good Bug, Bad Bug, which is a nice little field guide for identifying insects in the garden, and then Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, which is all about luring in those beneficial insects to help you control pests.
Real quickly, what is one of your tips on bringing in those beneficial insects to make your garden happier and healthier?
Excellent. Good. Well, aside from eliminating the use of pesticides in the garden, it's also creating habitat and making that habitat year-round. We gardeners tend to want to put our gardens to bed neat and tidy at the end of the season and cut everything down and rake it all out. And that basically takes away overwintering sites for all of our native pollinators and many of these species of pest-eating beneficial insects. So leave those gardens stand through the winter, do your cleanup in the mid to late spring of the following year, and you'll naturally boost your populations of those beneficial insects.
Well, Jessica, we greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us, sharing some of your gardening wisdom with Holly, myself, and all of our listeners.
Thank you, Jessica.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And-